In the coming week, the first anniversary of the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan is marked. China gets some rain after historic droughts, and French President Macron travels to Algeria amid growing energy concerns. It's August 25th, 2022, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, we're looking at the August 30th one-year anniversary of the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. We've had a bit of run-up to that already by marking the Taliban sweep into power occurred just prior to that. But we've also seen in that past year this cascade of economic problems and humanitarian problems for Afghanistan, including severe hunger crisis. Now, there's also controversy that continues over the U.S. policy of freezing something like $7 billion in Afghan assets. So, Jim, at the one-year mark of the U.S. troop withdrawal, what can we say about the situation in Afghanistan?
It's grim, Bob, and it's going to continue to be grim. Afghanistan was a fragile country to begin with before the Taliban came back into power. Today, it faces an economic crisis, an environmental crisis, and a political crisis. They all intersect and reinforce one another, creating a massive humanitarian crisis in a country of nearly 40 million people. The economic crisis has its roots in the fact that Afghanistan, for more than two decades, depended upon international financial assistance for its economy to run. That was cut off immediately in the wake of the Western, not just U.S., but Western removal of troops from Afghanistan. Add on top of that, sanctions intended to punish the Taliban, the freezing of Afghan government assets that reside mostly at the New York Federal Reserve, and then soaring commodity prices because of the Russian war in Ukraine, and you have the ingredients for an economic catastrophe. Even where food is available in the cities, there's no liquidity to be able to purchase things. People can't get their hands on money to be able to go and buy things. And you're hearing stories of people selling their kidneys, selling family heirlooms to be able to get money to buy food for their families. We have the environmental crisis. The country is suffering its worst drought in decades. That has a very obvious consequence. It suppresses food production in a country that needs to be able to produce food at home because it doesn't have the reserves to be able to import increasingly expensive food from overseas. And then you have the political crisis. The Taliban have the guns, but they don't look to have the competence to run the country. They've sidelined a lot of the people who have the technical ability to make a government or a country run. Then you have the additional problem that the Taliban is still trying to enforce its rule in many parts of the country. It is being attacked by members of the Islamic State in Khorasan, the ISK, which has conducted a terrorist campaign against the Taliban, in essence, giving the Taliban a taste of its own medicine. The result is a humanitarian crisis of epic proportions. It's estimated that more than 95% of Afghans don't have enough food to eat. Some 18 million Afghans face acute food insecurity, and some 4 million Afghan children are acutely malnourished. This, of course, takes us to the question, Bob, of what to do and who should do it. Afghanistan's woes, of course, are happening in the midst of a rise in demand around the globe for humanitarian relief resources. And a lot of attention right now is on Ukraine, which is absorbing a lot of particularly Western aid. But you also have crises in places like Yemen that we've discussed, across the Sahel and elsewhere. So it's not obvious that there's a lot of money out there that's going to come to Afghanistan, even if the Taliban had been cooperating. This has led calls for the United States to relax its sanctions and to unfreeze those Afghan government reserves. The argument here is that these penalties are unnecessarily punitive. They're punishing ordinary Afghans. The United States response, and response in some other Western capitals, is we don't want our money to go to fund the Taliban. The Taliban has been targeting minorities in Afghanistan, repressing women and girls, and continuing its alliance with Al-Qaeda. And here we, of course, have as example number one, the fact that Ayman Zawahiri, the leader of Al-Qaeda, was living in a safe house in Kabul, clearly protected by Taliban authorities until his killing earlier this month. So it is a dire situation, Bob, with no easy or simple solutions.
Jim, as I hear you run down the litany of problems, it's clear we're in a different world than we were the last time the Taliban was in control, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s. But there's some things that are strikingly the same, which is especially the matter of the intractability of the Taliban, their sort of unwillingness and sort of their incapability to be able to do anything to alleviate the situation. And one big difference as it pertains to that was in the previous go around, you know, there was this general consensus that this was an odious regime that needed to be squeezed to change its behavior. And by that, I mean, all of its neighbors in China and Russia, you know, the Security Council was strongly unified against the Taliban. And then the last straw was the 9/11 attacks. And then basically the mission to go in and, you know, oust them had broad support. And that's not the case now. You have certainly China and Russia and a few other states want to accord some diplomatic recognition to the Taliban. There's talks, I believe, going on at the moment about whether certain Taliban figures should be removed from sanctions. The U.S., I think, wants them to stay under sanction, and China, among others, does not. So do you see any international role outside of the U.S., which has incredible leverage with these assets that you mentioned, Jim? Is there any sort of other international role that might come into play here as it relates to the Taliban and the way they're acting?
Well, Bob, there's both a multilateral and bilateral aspect to your question. Let's take the multilateral aspect first. I don't see major multilateral organizations like the United Nations stepping up in a big way on Afghanistan, in part because, one, countries like the United States are opposed to taking steps that would significantly enrich the capacity of the Taliban. But even putting that aside, to go back to a point I made earlier, there's just a tremendous demand on humanitarian relief supplies. Afghanistan is a dire situation, but it's not the only dire situation. Again, we could equally be talking about how the world has neglected Yemen. We can talk about challenges across the Sahel. We could be talking about Ukraine and the deprivation that Ukrainians could be facing in this coming winter. On the bilateral level, there's nothing that prevents the Russians or the Chinese for stepping up in a big way to bankroll the Taliban. It is something, to the best of my knowledge, they have not chosen to do. Again, the Chinese clearly would like to have a presence in Afghanistan because of access to minerals. By all accounts, Afghanistan has considerable mineral resources, but those mineral resources are very hard to mine or to access if you don't have security. But the Chinese, again, as best as I can tell, have not weighed in any big way on that front.
So, Jim, that does leave the U.S. and other major powers with a real challenge on its hands to observe this ongoing crisis on multiple fronts in Afghanistan and not really have an effective way to deal with the Taliban, to have the unsavory choice of loosening up assets to watch the Taliban then use them or potentially abuse them. And on top of it all, you know, see Afghanistan turn into another security crisis potentially. I think it, again, puts the focus again on the wisdom of the U.S. withdrawal, but also there's all sorts of pro and con debates, I guess, that continue in that front too.
Well, certainly, Bob, there are a lot of debates among experts about whether there are ways to release funds to Afghanistan that the Taliban won't be able to access. Now, the United States has, over the course of the last year, relaxed some sanctions, but they haven't really produced the outcome that people who were calling for them had hoped for. So this is sort of a complex issue. Obviously, the Taliban could make things a lot easier if it decided to abide by minimal standards internationally, and it has chosen not to. Again, all the talk last year about how we had a new and more moderate Taliban has been disproved by the way the Taliban has acted once in office. I mean, serif on the old WHO line, you know, meet the new Taliban, same as the old Taliban. And I think that's quite true. Just one last thing I'll leave you with, Bob, about marking the one-year anniversary of the U.S. withdrawal. Whatever one thinks about the wisdom of the Biden administration's decision to remove U.S. troops and the way in which the withdrawal was conducted, or the wisdom of the Trump administration for striking the deal that the Biden administration said it had to abide by, one of the very interesting things is that as badly as the U.S. withdrawal went, and I think even Biden administration officials agree it went badly, the Biden administration handled the run-up to the war in Ukraine and the consequences of the Russian invasion of Ukraine about as well as can be. And it's sort of striking that the administration seemed caught flat-footed on the issue of Afghanistan. And there are a lot of complaints about how incompetently the administration had managed the situation, whereas the same people seem to have managed the situation in Ukraine quite competently. And again, going along with that, there was a lot of hand-wringing a year ago about how the mismanagement of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan would handicap American foreign policy over the long term. It would undermine American credibility. Countries wouldn't want to work with us and the rest. And I think the events of the past 12 months have really disproved a lot of that hand-wringing.
That's a well-made point, Jim. And I think in general, it's an ongoing giant lesson in some of the pitfalls of nation building, and that you're going to be seeing textbooks written about in days to come and years to come.
Certainly will, Bob. But let's talk now about China. It is experiencing record levels of heat and drought. This heat, and particularly the drought, which has seen water levels across the country fall to levels not seen in centuries, could have potential global ripple effects. It is disrupting Chinese industry. And of course, given that China in many ways is an exporter to the rest of the world, this could have significant consequences. So can you tell us a little bit more about how what's happening in China affects everybody else?
Sure, Jim. And just to put a reinforcing note on what you said in setting this up, as a meteorologist told Axios recently to describe the 70-day or so drought in China, quote, "I can't think of anything comparable to China's heat wave of summer 2022 in its blend of intensity, duration, geographic extent, and number of people affected." That was meteorologist Bob Henson speaking to Axios. And essentially, it's the world's most populous country, a large swath of it, not getting any water at all. Now, as we speak, it's parts of southern China are getting lashed with tropical storm, much welcome tropical storm, I would say. But it's going to need a lot more rain and sustained rain to in any way recover, and certainly the levels of rivers like the Yangtze River and others to recover from what has happened. And it is happening in the context of other droughts too, which we'll get into a little bit, Jim. But as you said, you know, China relies on its rivers for commerce. It relies on the water for hydropower. And it is an industrial, continues to be an industrial engine of the world, even with its struggles in this past year because of COVID lockdowns and so forth. And so it's coming to grips with its own, probably its own worst patch of what seems to be climate change induced weather. And China, by the way, has, while it continues to be the world's major emitter of heat-trapping gases, has moved fairly vigorously into renewables and does not have any strong element that we can see of its officialdom that denies climate change is happening and that is human-caused.
But this poses a problem for the Chinese, Bob, because they tried to build up hydropower as an alternative. But if you have a drought, you have less water, you can't run those turbines to generate energy that you need.
Good point, Jim. And so in general, I think we should point to the fact that China has tried in all of the above approach to its energy, at least to take care of present consumption needs. It's still using coal heavily, but also one of the major producers, if not the major producer of solar panels, for example, wind turbines. China is trying to do a lot of these things, but hydro was an area that it had seen great hope for. And it's going to have to do some serious calculation, as are many other countries, in response to what's happened. I mean, just to give you a sense of the many historic things that happened during this heat wave, Jim, the city of Chongqing, about 9 million people or so, its nighttime low was registered at 94 degrees Fahrenheit.
And this is in a city that doesn't have a lot of built-in air conditioning.
That is correct. And again, a country, various cities of which have been under severe lockdown, which has had its own toll on mental health and so forth, than to have to deal with oppressive heat. And there's no other way to describe it, Jim. So I think it's just, again, another reminder that the climate change impacts are global and that the country's going to need to deal with these collectively. And I'll just note, it's not just China in which its rivers have gone down and revealed 600-year-old Buddha statues and so forth. We've seen European rivers, the Danube, the Rhine, for example, down incredibly low and affecting passage there. In the case of those rivers, also revealing World War II-era ships, you know, that were sunk in these rivers. And the U.S. Southwest, lest we forget, has been undergoing its own severe drought.
Lake Mead is at its lowest level since they started filling it back in the late 1930s.
Yes. And again, these are rivers and reservoirs that are used by a large number of people, that are used by agriculture. And so there are ripple effects nationally, but also internationally, in that these are countries that, you know, need these water bodies for commerce and for food, and not having them, you know, adds to further stresses that the world is already seeing, as you referred to, Jim, earlier in this podcast about on the food supply front. So, you know, it's become, I guess, sort of a ritual thing for us in this podcast to do the late summer weather check. And it's only been getting more intense seemingly every year. The other thing that's happened, we've seen not only in the US, but elsewhere in the world, is that we've seen intense droughts, but we've also seen intense rainfall and flooding happen, what they're calling whiplash events, in which the same communities, and let's take the state of Texas in the US, which had severe drought and all sorts of concerns raised by that, then have rainfall in the order of 15 or 16 inches registered that caused their own damage, heavy damage. So it brings up again what's to be done. We've just had the most major sort of sweeping climate-related legislation passed in the U.S. under the Biden administration that's supposed to deal with providing much more incentivizing and funding for renewables. That's going to take time to roll out and so forth. But as our colleague Alice Hill has said, there wasn't as much attention paid in that legislation to what to deal with the problem as it exists now, which is the intense heat episodes, the intense forest fires, the prolonged droughts, the intense rainfall. All of these things require hardening of infrastructure, Jim, in public places, residential places, and so forth. And I think people might point to this summer, perhaps, as a time when you have more of an intensified global conversation going on about how to toughen up the world for the existing problems, let alone...
That adaptation, Bob, is going to be extraordinarily expensive to do.
Yeah. And it's not helped by the fact that, you know, at least currently under the current geopolitical tensions, the U.S. and China have broken off climate-related talks, among other things, due to the tensions over Taiwan.
Do you think that really matters, Bob, at the end of the day? Because decisions about reducing the emission of heat-trapping gases are really domestic issues. It doesn't really require international coordination. The Chinese either decide to build more coal-fired power plants or they don't. We either decide to increase reliance on electric vehicles or not. Does that really need to be negotiated between Beijing and Washington?
No, I think it's important not to overstate that, to be sure, Jim. And I think you're right. They are, at the end of the day, local decisions that drive the change. But I do think it's important to keep the international conversation, especially going between the two major emitting countries, because they could potentially feed off each other and provide some, maybe an additional momentum to changing policies and to learn from each other, frankly. I do think you're going to see a lot of places around the world watching what happens, say, in the U.S. state of California, which just announced this week they're going to be holding a vote, I think as soon as today, about changing regulations to require that after the year 2035, any new vehicles cannot be creating carbon emissions, which is a huge change. And what does that mean in terms of how automakers respond and how various supply chains respond and so forth? Those things are interconnected. At the same time, to your point, Jim, it is localities that make the difference. And I do think changes can occur without big time summitry going on and everything else, but they do add a sense of momentum and a sense of sort of shared ideas, potentially loosening up trade in some areas that could foster, you know, changes in areas that are less carbon intensive.
Bob, you know, you talk about trying to move forward the energy transition. I think it's critical to make that happen. I think it is good that we have the Inflation Reduction Act that makes some steps toward reducing emissions. I don't think it goes far enough because the size of the problem is so immense. But I think we're going to be hearing a lot more in the years to come about, let's call them the moral hazards created by the energy transition. Just to take one small slice, it is one thing to say that we need to have more electric vehicles, rely more on batteries to run things. The challenge is going to be many of those technological innovations require minerals that are relatively scarce. And so then you have to figure out how do you get them? And then this growing concern that in the process of trying to do the right thing, we're going to create a lot of problems because many of these minerals require mining that creates its own set of environmental hazards and the rest. It's not like you can immediately order up, you know, 100 times as much cobalt or lithium or a whole variety of rare earth minerals. So there are a lot of details that still have to be worked out, and some of them could be quite unpleasant. Now, I know some people will say technology will fix this, things that are expensive will find ways to get around, and history has suggested that is true, but it doesn't necessarily mean that those technological fixes or substitutions are going to happen quickly or on the timeline we may want them.
Yeah, I mean, just to take the case of lithium alone, if you do any sort of close scrutiny of what's involved in getting lithium out of the ground and convert it into efficient batteries, it can be a really messy, nasty process. And the not in my backyard aspect is going to be an intense one to deal with. So it is by no means an easy path, but I do think you get a sense, partly driven by the weather intensity, which people are noting year after year is only getting bigger, that something has to be done. And maybe this is a moment where attentions are more focused, Jim. So
there's two things I would flag there. One, I was recently reading that there is increased interest in potentially mining in Greenland. Apparently, Greenland has a number of minerals that could be critical to an energy transition. That gets you into arguments about whether you want to have that kind of activity taking place in what has been a very pristine part of nature. The other thing is that a lot of the mining takes place in countries that are poor and poorly governed. And you get into equity issues. Are countries like Congo or Bolivia going to be exploited by the rest of the globe as they try to make this energy transition? How do you do it in such a way that Bolivians or Congolese, or you go on the list of countries, get something out of this whole process? And I think this is a very complicated issue that is going to get a lot more attention as we go forward.
I would just note there, Jim, that Democratic Republic of Congo recently had an auction of a swath of its pristine forest area that has raised a lot of concern. It's one of the countries referred to as the lungs of the earth, or at least its vast jungle and forest has been referred to as that. So it's yet another area of concern for the reasons you mentioned. But let's stick with the energy theme, Jim, and go to North Africa, where Emmanuel Macron is traveling to Algeria. He's actually arrived there already today as we were taping this podcast. Now, among other things, Algeria has large natural gas reserves, and that has become of increased interest to European Union markets after the restriction of Russian energy imports. So, Jim, what should we be looking for during this trip?
Certainly, Bob, President Macron's trip to Algeria is at least in part about getting access to natural gas. Algeria is the world's seventh largest exporter of natural gas, third largest exporter of natural gas to Europe. And as you note, natural gas is in short supply in Europe as we head into what could be a very difficult winter. The challenge for Macron in terms of natural gas right now is that Algeria's natural gas is already subscribed. A number of countries, particularly Italy, moved very quickly in the beginning of the Ukraine crisis to try to lock up access to natural gas. So it's not clear that Macron is going to be able to come back from his stops in Algiers, in Iran, which is Algeria's second largest city, with more gas for France going into this winter. I do think a big part of this visit by Macron is to try to mend fences with Algeria. And give you a little bit of context. When Macron won the presidency the first time back in 2017, he was hailed by many Algerians for his willingness to denounce what he called French crimes against humanity in Algeria. Keep in mind that Algeria was annexed by France back in 1830 and was remained part of France until it won its independence back in 1962 in a very bloody civil war. In recent years, Macron had become more critical of the government in Algeria, led by Abdelmadjid Tebboune, for its suppression of democratic elements, calls for a greater openness in Algeria. And then last fall, remarks that Macron apparently gave at a dinner party were leaked. And in those remarks, he reportedly questioned whether Algeria really existed as a country before the French arrived. And he argued that Algerians had rewritten their history based on a hatred of France. As you can imagine, that did not go over terribly well with Algerians, whether we're talking about Algerians in power or ordinary citizens of Algeria. So I think part of what Macron is trying to do is to walk that back and try to generate better relations between Algiers and Paris.
Yeah, and that last part in particular, Jim, seems to be worthy of such a visit. And, you know, whatever he achieves on the energy front, I would assume would be a bonus, although obviously there are going to be concerted efforts in that area. But it does also bring to mind, you know, what had been not too long ago a French objective, which was to really spearhead a new productive relations with this part of Africa. I think it was under President Sarkozy. It was a whole initiative laid out with white papers and everything else. And it was going to be this sort of new era of French ties to the region, with economic aspects being a big part. You know, any sense of whether the rebuilding of a broader economic ties could be part of what's on the table with this visit?
Well, the two countries do have extensive economic relations. You mentioned the fact that France does get natural gas from Algeria, and France also gets a fair amount of oil from Algeria. So there's significant economic relations existing currently. I think one of the issues that will obviously be on the table is that there have been some recent finds that suggest that Algeria has even more natural gas reserves. The question then is, who invests in it? How is the infrastructure financed? Where does that natural gas go? Again, that's not a short-term play for the challenges that France and Europe are going to face this winter, or potentially face this winter. It's really sort of a longer-term issue going forward. I should also note that obviously France and Algeria have deep connections on a cultural issue. A number of French citizens trace their roots to Algeria, which is, you know, not surprising given that Algeria was for 100 years considered to be part of France. So, I mean, the two countries have deep ties, even if there's a great deal of bitterness left over from that colonial rule.
Anyone familiar with the writings of Camus will see a major undertone involving Algeria. I recommend reading all of Camus, especially his writings that relate to his time in Algeria.
With that, Bob, it's time to pivot to our audience figure of the week segment. As always, our listeners can vote on or tweet us a figure of the week at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience selected 21 dead in Somali hotel. Can you tell us about the event our listeners are flagging for us, Bob?
Yes, Jim. This is a reminder that Somalia's extreme troubles, which run the gamut and are in some ways similar to Afghanistan's, have not subsided. And in fact, one of the main ones is the ongoing insurgency by an Al-Qaeda affiliate known as Al-Shabaab. And Al-Shabaab was behind this siege at a major hotel in Mogadishu that ended up with a minimal level of people killed that are about 21. It could be much higher than that, more than 100 people wounded in an action involving, you know, state forces striking back against Al-Shabaab fighters who took a lot of people hostage in a hotel, and showed basically the ability of this group to conduct such attacks. It has been for years conducting a number of attacks, many small scale and occasional large ones. But this is the first one on a hotel in the capital since January 2021, by the accounts I've seen. And it started out with suicide car bombs and then the siege of a hotel. In this case, it's the Hyatt Hotel. The siege lasted about 30 hours. It was a hotel that was considered to be fairly secured, and a number of government officials preferred to stay there for that reason. And yet, Shabaab penetrated it, and a number of people were killed. It was considered a real statement type of move by Shabaab toward the still relatively new government in Somalia, that it is not to be messed with and that it is not going away. We should also note that after the recent U.S. targeted killing of Ayman al-Zawahiri, that the Al-Qaeda under his watch became a group that was very much decentralized. So its affiliates grew stronger, while so-called Al-Qaeda Central maybe was not as robust anymore. And one of those affiliates is Al-Shabaab. And it is still, as we've seen in this incident, still very lethal. The Long War Journal, a publication that tracks these types of things, noted this week that the suicide bombings that took place at this hotel last Friday bring the number of suicide bombings just this year by Shabaab to 27, and that the group has carried out at a minimum 82 suicide bombings inside Somalia since 2020. So still very lethal, and still something for Somalia to have to come to grips with.
Bob, you mentioned the name of the hotel was the Hyatt. Just to be clear for our listeners, it's not part of the Hyatt chain of hotels that people here in the United States may be familiar with. But speaking about Al-Shabaab, Bob, do we have a clear idea of what it is trying to accomplish?
It's a really good question, given that traditionally it was an Al-Qaeda affiliate that had the sort of standard line from Al-Qaeda affiliates, which is chuck the infidels out of the country. And by infidels, any sort of foreign forces, and of which there have been a number in Somalia over the years, but also any domestic forces that don't believe in the true Islam, you know, that the true believers in the Al-Qaeda affiliate believe in. Now, in the case of Al-Shabaab, there has been indications that it might be seeking to have more of a role in sort of taking part in the government, as you're still sort of seeing the country coalesce. The country, which has up until very recently was widely referred to as a failed state, is trying to put together its sort of own cohesive functioning government. But, you know, and just in May was the election of Hassan Sheikh Mohammed as president, and he had promised to fight the group both ideologically and financially. So it raises the question, one, is it at all realistic after such an attack and such a series of attacks, frankly, that Shabaab has any role in a government? That's one thing. But also, the hearts and minds of Somalis, you know, are not going to be turned by such attacks either. So it's really just showing an extremist element that continues to have a strong, dedicated core of people, as we have seen in other places in Africa and in the Middle East with these Al-Qaeda affiliates and groups like Boko Haram and so forth. Just the ability to launch bold attacks and just really cruel and really deadly raises a lot of concern, and again raises questions for the countries that have committed to trying to stabilize Somalia. And you have, you know, the U.S. is still active in the area, especially with drone strikes, and it routinely conducts them against Al-Shabaab and reports kills and so forth. But yet, at the end of the day, it's not clear whether it's having any impact.
No, it's not, Bob.
Well, that's our look at the turbulent world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. A European Parliament committee will investigate the use of Pegasus and other surveillance spyware. And the G20 environment and climate ministers meet in Bali. And I should say, not a moment too soon.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. We love the feedback. The books mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Rafaela Seward, with senior podcast producer Gabrielle Sierra. Marcus Zacharia engineered this episode. Thank you, Marcus. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying so long.
And this is Bob McMahon saying goodbye, and be careful out there.